Hello, folks, and welcome to the ACH podcast. I'm Sheepdog, and on this episode, I'm going to be talking about two of the biggest barriers that members of the ACH have told me affect their ability to find work. So I normally interview people on the podcast, and the past three episodes have been me interviewing other people about their jobs. But one of the things I thought I would do is just kind of hear from other autistics about what their problems actually are, have a look at whether I can, you know, find any kind of advice or give any advice, and then use that kind of those problems to shape future interviews and just give a bit more flavor around, you know, hearing from the people who the podcast is for, getting their voice on the podcast and just looking at what we can do and whether there's anything there. Hopefully some businesses will hear this and make changes, and hopefully people can reach out and make suggestions. If you're listening on the likes of Spotify, they have feedback bits where you can write comments and send it back to the show. Please feel free to use them. Obviously, I can use them on future episodes, or at least pass them back to the ACH crew and they can read the advice and take it on board from there. So I'm going to go with the second biggest problem and build up to the first. It also just happens to work nicely that they're kind of in that order of the chain. So one of the biggest problems that quite a lot of people flagged up was that initial knowing you're qualified, building your CV or resume, feeling like you are qualified to apply for a job, knowing which bits you can ignore, how to ignore bits, whether to bother replying at all. And then just the whole fact that it takes so long to do and then you may never hear back, it's a bit of a gamble on whether or not to apply. Now, it's fair. A lot of people are saying that if a job tells you that to qualify for this job, you need to be able to do this, 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 and this, and have this many years experience and so forth, that if you've got less than half of those years or less than half of those skills, it may not be worth you applying for the job, or it may not be worth you putting the effort in to apply for it, especially if you've got limited, what people call spoons, or, you know, mental energy to expend on that each day. So I completely get that. It's a very valid problem. It's a very common problem. It's a very big thing for lots of people. And I feel like the issue with the being qualified for the job, businesses could help on that a lot by having a minimum and an ideal requirement. You know, this is the minimum specification for what we're looking for. This is the ideal candidate. And, you know, we're willing to accept most of this. We will be willing to put training in place or to show you the ropes or that kind of thing. The amount of times I've applied for jobs and they've mentioned skills that you must have, and then the job's never involved that. It was just somebody copy and pasting a job spec or something like that from there. Now, a lot of people said that they rigidly will follow the rules. They will see what's set out there as a rule and they will want to follow it, so it puts them off applying at all. And so then from the employer's point of view, they're missing out on a good candidate that could have applied for that and could have succeeded in getting the job and doing really well at it. I mentioned in one of the other podcasts, I don't think I'd have qualified for my job if I'd applied a different route. I didn't have the necessary experiences and qualifications and so forth to get it, but obviously I've done it for 8 years, so people would have been happy with what I'd done in the job and would have been happy with me being there, and my feedback has always been very positive. So to think that I could have applied for a similar job elsewhere or applied for this job in a different life and not got it is very bizarre to me, because I wouldn't have met any of the criteria, I wouldn't have filled it out, I just ended up in it by a sheer fluke. And I feel like that isn't something you can control. Now, one piece of advice I did give on the fly with that, which I did get responses on and reasons why it doesn't particularly work for people, was that I said that when I was younger, a lot of the time I would apply for jobs via recruitment agencies, because the way that works is you talk to one recruiter, you tell them everything about you, you give them your CV, and then they go and do all the legwork. They go to people and they say, this is Sheepdog, you know, this is his qualifications, this is what he does, here's his CV, would you like to interview him? And then they call you in for an interview. And for me, that worked quite well in that I got interviews and I got jobs. But on the flip side, it meant that I didn't have any control over where I ended up or what I ended up doing. I kind of got a phone call going, would you be interested in doing this? And I had to then go and research what that was. And that's how I spent 6 months of my life training to be an insurance underwriter for no reason other than it was the job that the recruiter put me towards. And it was a horrid job, a very bad time, not a very good environment for me at all. Now, the first bit of feedback on that advice was very much that they feared talking to recruiters as they were unclear on what jobs they would be put forward for. And then lots of people were saying that they were worried about the type of environment they could end up in, which my personal experience showed that I did end up in an environment that I wasn't particularly comfortable in. I wouldn't say that that is going to be the universal experience. I've worked with a few ex-recruiters in my job and heard about the sort of roles and ways it all works. And it is on the recruiter's benefit to get you into a job that you're comfortable in. For example, the one I specifically spoke to about this job, they said that their job was to place people in a job and then they'd receive 10% of the annual wage of that person if they placed them. So for them, that if they found an ideal candidate for a high paying, let's say £90,000 a year job, they would get £9,000 commission for placing that person at work. So it wouldn't be paid immediately up front, here is your 9K. It would be, here's X amount up front and another X once they pass probation. So if you go in there and you don't pass probation, it's actively costing the recruitment person. Now, I'm not saying that as a way to make you feel bad or stress you out about the idea of I'm going to cost them money if I don't pass. It's more a case of they're only putting you forward because they think you're going to pass. They think you're going to get through that placement and get through that period of where they've got to vet you and check that you're all out of probation, and they think they're going to get their money out of it. It sounds cynical, but that is the job. Not everyone acts purely on the money, but if they're businesses, which they all are, the recruiters are there to earn their living, it is a factor. It's a factor that means they're not just throwing you into jobs willy-nilly. My mum used to say to me, well, you'd worry that a recruiter would just scattergun your CV around to literally anyone and just see where they can fill you. But those people probably exist, but they're not the ideal ones. They're not the successful ones. If you look at a recruiter's history, if you look at their specialisms, if you look at what their interests are, if you get to know them, if you actually spend time talking to them, because I have worked with some who rang me and they were just like, you know, give us your details, I'll see what I can do. And then they're ringing you going, would you like to work in a warehouse? Would you like to work in a shop? And you're thinking, these jobs are nothing alike one another. And you're just, you know, throwing out any old thing. Whereas the one I specifically spoke to ended up with the insurance underwriter. They knew I'd worked in insurance before. They knew I'd worked in an office before. They were trying to find me a similar role that fit the skills that I had. And then underwriting was a little bit out of that. And they sort of said to me, would I be interested in learning? I could go and do my underwriting training. And it sounded like a good idea at the time, but I wasn't the right fit for the team. I feel like that is still a valuable option for people because it does cut out a lot of the unknowns. It does cut out a lot of the, should I apply for this? Because somebody else is looking at what you've got and they're chatting to people. They know who to talk to. I've sort of had this discussion with people before in that I know a lot of businesses, I mean, the one I work for doesn't deal with random recruiters, doesn't deal with applicants just on the cold who just turn up and ask if they've got any jobs going. They have a recruitment agency they speak to and they say, find me an account manager, find me a technical expert. And the recruiter brings them the best five people they could find or whatever it is. And if that's the sort of company you want to end up working at, if you want to work in a specific field, finding the recruitment company they speak to, finding who they work with, or finding someone who's a specialist in their field and knows what they're looking for is the route. It's just one of those things, especially in tech. It is the thing. I've had plenty of security vendor recruiters come to me and say, I work with all of the big security vendors from around the world who build firewalls and antivirus software and that kind of thing, and they say they're looking for someone to be involved in their bid team. Would you be willing to come and apply for a job with them? And for me personally, I'll get to reasons why later on, but I've said no basically every time. But for you, it could be that you're saying, I want to get into a creative career. And you could go speak to someone who specializes in talking to, you know, publishers or creative agencies or whatever it is. You know, you could talk to someone who specializes in sort of software development, and they might know which developers are looking for which skills. And they do that pre-vetting. A lot of people have said that they worry about HR departments getting it wrong. If you get the right recruiter, they're going to actually know what they're looking for and they're going to put the effort in, because the good ones know they make more money by getting that right. And this isn't a pitch for recruiters. This isn't a pitch for, they're the problem, just, you know, they're the panacea for all the problems, but it's a fundamental part of modern recruitment and modern job hunting. And if you're trying to do it all manually by hand and filling out forms on websites, that is exhausting. There still will be plenty of that, but at least when you're applying, you will have had that kind of extra layer of somebody going, I know what's going on here. I know how many people are put forward for this, and I think you've got a good case. And you can ask them direct questions. They're not there to hide information from you. They're not there to say, you're definitely going to get it, and then they're actually stitching you up. They you can say to them, how many other people have you put in for this? Do you think I've got a good chance? Or are you just kind of boosting your chances? You know, what's the fit like? Or you can just say to them, you know, I need something that's going to fit my needs. And that I've looked as well. There are, depending on where you live, there are neurodivergent specialists who will specialize in recruitment for autistic people and ADHD and so on and so forth. They have their various different expertise in what area they feel that they know the most about and can find people jobs for. But that is entirely based on where you live and what industry you're looking at. So it's probably not the kind of cover all the answer that it could be. So moving on to the big issue that honestly, literally everybody flagged this as an issue. It was, I expected it, and I think most of you probably would have as well, but it was interesting how literally every answer covered this in one way or another. One person started there, so tying it into the applying for the jobs. One person was saying they've been in the same job for 15 years without applying for a promotion. They eventually got asked if they'd like to apply for a promotion, and they thought, okay, I feel comfortable applying for this. I know what I'm doing. I've been here for 15 years. I reckon I could do this next job. And then they hit the autistic worker's number one problem. They had to do an interview. Now, in their example, they didn't pass the interview, but they were lucky enough that another manager saw them and said, if they don't hire you, we will. And they took them to their department and they got a promotion out of it overall. But every single person who replied to my question said that they hate the interview process. And I can completely empathize with you all. It is dreadful and it needs an overhaul. It needs some sort of neurodivergent accessibility upgrade that helps us get through that process, because I've probably had, I want to say, 3 interviews in the past decade. I didn't interview for my current job because I knew one of the directors. I mentioned that before. I had to obviously meet them and answer some questions, but it's very much, oh no, I can do this, I can do that, let me have a crack at it. And it went well. I applied for a job as a teacher. That was interesting. I feel like that was quite rigid in that it was fill out these exams, have a chat with a team. They'd read my CV. There's very specific questions. But the other person on the interview was a little bit confusing. They didn't really know what they were doing. They kept asking me if I'd help them with their test. And I kept thinking, well, aren't we competing? You know, it's a very bizarre scenario. And then I've had the classic, you know, someone rings you, they ask you 50 questions. You're trying desperately to think about what to say each time, having a back and forth, trying to listen to what they're saying and then relay it back without saying, I forgot the question, sorry. And trying to not go off on a tangent too far and that kind of thing. And that's the bit that puts me off, because when I had that call, I wasn't sure how it went. I couldn't see the person on the other end. It was a phone call to like a preliminary chat before they invite me in for a face-to-face. And I think it went okay in that they were like, we would be interested in chatting further, but then it didn't actually go anywhere ultimately, because once we had that next chat, it didn't feel right and it didn't work. But everyone said the biggest problem for them is not knowing how to prep for the questions and then being bamboozled by the random things that you're asked. Now, lots of people said things like being asked ridiculous questions, like if you were an animal, what would you be and why? Or being asked open-ended questions that you're kind of unsure when to stop talking or when to finish answering the question, because it is completely unclear to you whether or not you've hit what they wanted you to hit. And immediately off the bat, like, there are resources out there that employers can use that advise them on what sort of questions to ask or how to behave in these interviews to help people. Now, everyone was saying that they don't like the feeling of being scrutinized, trying to maintain a steady talking speed. I mean, some of you will have noticed my talking speed changes on the podcast all the time. I've had to learn how to change the tempo of some of the episodes because my speed was just all over the place. I'm trying very hard to talk just slower today, and I'm hoping I've achieved that. I'm hoping I've not gone too far the opposite way, but I'm trying my hardest to talk at a human speed, because I noticed in at least one of the interviews I was talking at a light speed. It was ridiculous. So trying to focus on that, if I was being interviewed by you now for a job, trying to focus on that is too much on its own. But not knowing when to stop talking about a topic, obviously, again, I missed a tangent, I would have that problem in interviews. The silly questions thing, I feel like, depends on the person. Not everyone listening is going to have that issue, but a lot of people had it. And also the thing that we've all probably experienced at one point in our lives, group interviews, where you have to hear and do your answer in front of other people. You have to endure trying to be one of the gang and show that you can build rapport with people and, you know, mix in with people. And these things are not great. These are not healthy for us. These are not the greatest of environments in general for us. I know that's not a cover all, but that's a stereotype for a reason. A lot of us experience it. Now, doing some research on this, as I say, employers can get information online for this. And one of the places I went to was the National Autistic Society. The website's autism.org.uk. They have a page called Interview Tips for Employers, and it talks about what they can do. I'm not going to sit here and read a website to you all. If you want to look at it, it's obviously there, but I will cover some of the very brief things, especially because I have some experience in how these affect you. Now, checking your lighting was number two on their list. And the reason that's there is because, and I didn't know this was a thing for autistics, but it's a thing that plagued me. The lighting can absolutely ruin your focus. I used to fall asleep in meetings all of the time unless the lighting was turned off. And it was only that one of my bosses happened to turn it off one day, or it wasn't on, and we were in a meeting and we noticed I didn't fall asleep. It wasn't I was falling asleep, it was that I was so overwhelmed that my eyes were closing. I'd think I was listening. Someone would say, "Why are you asleep?" I'd say, "I'm not asleep." And then I realized that I wasn't actually looking. My eyes had been shut for God knows how long. In an interview, trying to focus on what someone's saying or what you're being asked with the lights buzzing or causing you issues like that is not productive. It's part of the reason you feel like you can't think. That's part of the cause of that processing issue. A lot of people were saying they feel like they're asked a question and they feel like they're on the spot, their mind goes blank, and they just can't track it all. And that is because things like the lighting are subconsciously draining something from you. I don't know what exactly it is, but I know that the moment those lights were off, my focus was massively improved. It made such a big difference to me. And it was the advice on the NAS website as well, that the lighting is an issue, and it really genuinely is. So if you're finding that you just go blank and you can't process on the spot, just check whether it is the lights. It should make a difference. One of the ones I mentioned before, and the first one they listed, was not asking open-ended questions. Having a genuine closed question of like, can you do this, or have you done this before, or, you know, tell me about a specific time when this has happened, is much better than, you know, just a general tell me about yourself, and then you're just there info dumping for the next 20 minutes because no one's stopping you and they don't know how to stop you. Now, that is critical in that it also gives them something to measure. It's beneficial for them because they can compare the answers very easily if they're very closed answered questions. Asking about real experiences, like, did you do this at your last job, is much more useful than, if you were a banana, would you be yellow? I don't know why that came out in a random way there, but I can't do random silly questions, obviously. I don't see what benefit it had. I guess to them, it shows that you've got a sense of humor or that you can be abstract, but I feel like we can be very abstract. It's not on command. It's not performance. It's not just for no reason. It's got to have a reason to do it. And in an interview, it doesn't really fit, does it? Interpreting language differently is obviously a big issue for us, everybody, but for me personally, massively. When people say things to me, the amount of times I understand it a certain way, or even if I clarify it a certain way, it turns out I was still wrong. And I think I'm okay with metaphor, but not all autistics are. So it feels like just making sure that the language used is going to be very clear and concise and direct. And that I feel like cutting people some slack if they don't fully understand it. Just because they don't understand it in that instance doesn't mean they're always going to have that problem, because I'm quite good at communicating to an extent myself, but there will be times when I just completely misunderstand what someone has said and it makes me feel like an absolute moron. Giving someone space and a quiet time and a bit of, you know, diffusing moments midway through it, like a break every 5-10 minutes, however long the interview is, just cutting into slices to say, let's have a minute, let's have a sip of our drink, let's just catch a beat. That can help everyone. It doesn't have to be a specific autistic person benefit, but just getting a break makes a difference. Allowing processing time, obviously, for questions. I feel like that is one where it kind of ties into the other distractions. So if there's lighting or noise or anything like that going on, smells in the room, just general stresses, that's going to cause issues. But allowing that processing time either way is also just going to give people a moment to give their best answer rather than forcing an answer out and going a bit willy-nilly. I feel like a lot of this stuff, so a lot of you are probably going to be listening and go, well, this doesn't help me in an interview myself, Sheepdog, come on. And I'm thinking some of this is going to be a confidence issue, because you will need to have the confidence to say, can I have a moment to just collect my thoughts? Can I have a 1 minute break just to grab a drink, just to get my, you know, mind back on focus or feeling good or whatever it is you need to say, to just say, I just want a quick break just to pull myself together. Being able to say, I didn't understand that. Can you just re-clarify it just so I can make sure I've understood this properly? You've said this. Do you mean this? Yep, cool. Okay, let's crack on. I feel like that can be worded in a way that shows you think about things. I was going to say meticulous, but I didn't know if that's the right word. You're actually going through, just checking. Okay, you're measuring twice, cutting once, instead of just going for it kind of thing. When someone says about real experiences, maybe clarifying the question or just tying it in exactly to what they say, just clarifying that they've got what they want, being able to say, have I answered your question? If they might say, well, no, not quite. What about this? You know, being able to say to somebody, I'm just going to tell you now, the lighting in here is a little bit buzzy and it may affect my focus. Could we maybe turn the lights off a moment? I'm pretty sure 9 times out of 10 people are going to say yes, and they're going to allow that accommodation. It's not something that they have to really think about beyond just turning it off. You know, they're not going to have to worry about that. There's things in there where people might not realize that you're not making eye contact, or maybe you're talking in a certain way, or you're acting in a certain way, or you're not, you know, we all have different tones to our voices and that kind of thing that can come across like you're not engaged in an interview, or like you're not able to communicate very well. And it's nothing to do with those things at all. It's just that we all struggle to kind of control our voices or regulate the way we're talking or the way we're sitting or the way we're looking. And our eye contact is not consistent. I mean, mine definitely isn't. And my voice goes up and down and different depending on who or when or what I'm speaking to at any point. So I think with that one, and I think with a lot of this, I've been umming and ahhing about this as an answer to some of this. And I did Google this for a bit. I did sort of ask around, not publicly, but I wanted to just get thoughts on disclosure and whether it's worth bringing it up front and being kind of open with people you're applying for jobs with. And this bit here is purely opinion based, and I absolutely welcome other people's views. I'm not saying I'm correct. I'm not saying it's going to be the right answer for everyone. I'm not saying do it 100%. You do you, take it or leave it. But I feel if I am applying for another job tomorrow, let's say, I'm not, but let's say I was, if I was speaking to a recruitment agent, I would probably say, I'm Sheepdog, I'm looking for a job in this field. I work in cybersecurity at the moment, so it would be reasonable for me to say, look, a technical reseller within the same industry, or at least selling the same sort of thing, someone who's big in the public sector, because I've been doing tenders in the public sector for a while. Yeah, these are the other skills I've got. And I say, by the way, please tell them I am autistic and I will need some accommodations. I feel telling people up front is going to avoid that kind of awkwardness of wondering whether I should tell them in probation, whether I should tell them after probation, whether I should spring it on them at some point 6 months in and say, oh, by the way, I need you to do this. It just says up front, look, I'm going to need you to understand me. I'm going to need you to make space for me. And I kind of feel like having really given it thought before I actually recorded this and actually put this out on the internet as advice, if a company says, oh God, I'm not hiring him, duh, I don't really want to work there, you know, because they're not going to do that at the start. And then actually, if I'd snuck under the radar and got in the door and gone, I'm autistic, I fooled you, they're not going to go, oh, okay. And, you know, 6 months in, when I randomly go, oh, I need accommodations because I'm autistic, I've been fooling you all along, they're not going to go, oh, okay. They're going to give the exact same reaction, whether it be 1 day in, 3 months in, 6 months in, a year in. If they're going to be weird about it. If they're going to be rubbish about it, they're going to be rubbish about it. That's my thought on that. Now, I get that's debatable, and I get there may be people who go, well, if it comes down to two candidates that are identical and one is and one isn't, what do they do then? And I get it. I do get it. I feel like that is a gamble. But I keep coming back to that logic of, well, do you really want to work with the one who would say no? The one who would use that against you as a rod to beat you with. I feel like there are options out there. There are companies out there. There are so many people out there willing to help and work with us and support us and make sure that we do get to work and that kind of thing, that see the value in what we can bring. And that is something that I guess as well is worth mentioning as a roundup point, is there are businesses out there who do champion neurodivergent workers. The tech industry has an abundance of them. I know that's not the industry for everyone. You know, there's plenty of creatives listening who are like, well, that doesn't help me go and get a job in a sort of design studio or animation studio or, you know, all these other things that they could be doing with their degrees in fine art or graphic design and so on and so forth. But it's the same sort of difference. There will be companies out there who specialize in it that have a program dedicated to it. And I mean, apart from that, it's kind of one of those where even then there will be ones who just don't mind. There will be recruiters who help you get into them and make sure that you are supported. And legally speaking, I mean, I've done the comics about this. The accommodations they need to provide aren't that. They're not expensive. They don't cost anything most of the time. I mean, being able to say turn off a light or not make the room as uncomfortable for you is very minimal. There are some things they can do. There are needs that people will have that will cost money, but that's, again, different. And it will depend on the level of skill that you're required to bring to the job. And if you can bring that to the job, then it's a conversation for them to have. But I just feel like being upfront and saying it is one of those things where it's going to weed out a lot of the bad apples in the jobs that you're applying for. And it's going to probably speed things up quite a bit, because the ones inviting you in, you know, you got through, you know, you got invited on your own premise, your own basis, your own self. You know, you were there because you were upfront, and they know you, they know what they're expecting. And I feel like that is my kind of take on this. And it's easy for me to say, I know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. I think, you know, if I get a lot of responses that are saying the opposite, or there's other things I haven't considered, I'll bring them up on a future show. But yeah, I just feel like transparency, openness, it should help. I know it's annoying that we even have to have this debate, that we even have to think about this. But yeah, it's definitely played on my mind. It's definitely played on my mind that when I move to another job in future, will I want to be able to have to tell someone all these things, and will it hold me back, and will it affect me? But I've just, as I say, come to the conclusion that if a company is going to hold it against me, then I wouldn't want to work there in a million years. And yeah, the other thing is, again, we could touch on this in another episode. I'm going to wrap up in a moment, but looking at whether there's something you can start yourself is obviously a big thing that lots of autistics have done. A lot of the people that I've got lined up for future episodes have gone the self-employed route. They've done their own thing, and they're thriving in it. And there is a lot of support out there for neurodivergence to get grants, to get support, to get funding, whatever it is that will help you do your own thing in your own way. And working with others like you, like us, we could work together on things. You know, you could find someone willing to work with you to cover a gap in skills that you don't have. That's an option too. Now, I'm doing the autism thing of not knowing when to stop, so I'm going to make myself stop now. Thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry this is a bit of a random one. It is just me rambling for half an hour straight, but I hope it's been useful. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you're on Spotify, you can fire your thoughts straight off in the questions and answer bit on the show. If you're not, I'm on Twitter at RB6K. Fire them there. I'm also on LinkedIn as Richard Bass. You can leave a review on iTunes. Please leave a review everywhere, wherever you listen to it. Share the podcast around. I'm sorry if things have been a bit off on this one. I am recording this late at night after a hectic week. Hopefully it's not been too visible, audible, but it's been a hectic one. But we will be back to business as usual after this episode. I've got a lovely interview lined up for Saturday. I'm really looking forward to that. And I hope you enjoy it. So listen to that when that comes out as well. Thanks for your time. Catch you all soon. Cheers.